Fangloy ang gawa na katulorali fadaga. Fangloy ang gawa na katulorali fadaga. Fangloy ang gawa na katulorali fadaga.
Welcome to the 93rd of the Cthulhu Podcast. I'm FNH. As usual, we'll start with the next part of Through the Brazilian Wilderness, then we'll have a 1920s musical number, and then on to Chapter 11 of At the Mountains of Madness. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, Part 53. After breakfast at Bonifacio, a number of Nambucaras, men, women and children, strolled in. The men gave us an exhibition of not very good archery. When the bow was bent, it was at first held so that the arrow pointed straight upwards, and was then lowered so that the arrow aimed straight at the target. Several of the women had been taken from other tribes, after their husbands or fathers had been killed. For the Nambucaras are light-hearted robbers and murderers. Two or three miserable dogs accompanied them, half-starved and mangy, but each was decorated with a collar of beads. The headman had three or four wives apiece, and the women were the burden-bearers, but apparently were not badly treated. Most of them were dirty, although well-fed-looking, and their features were of a low type, but some, especially among the children, were quite attractive. From Bonifacio we went about 7 miles, across a rolling prairie dotted with trees and clumps of shrub. There, on February 24th, we joined Amilcar, who was camped by a brook which flowed into the Duvida. We were only some 6 miles from our place of embarkation on the Duvida, and we divided our party and our belongings. Amilcar, Miller, Mello, and Oliveira were to march 3 days to the Gai Parana, and then descend it, and continue down the Madeira to Manos. Rondon, Lyra, the Doctor, Cherry, Kermit, and I, with 16 paddlers in 7 canoes, were to descend the Duvida, and find out whether it led into the Gai Parana. Our purpose was to return and descend to Ananas, whose outlet was also unknown. Having this in view, we left a fortnight's provisions for our party of 6 at Bonifacio. We took with us provisions for about 50 days, not full rations, for we hoped, to our part, to live on the country, on fish, game, nuts, and palm tops. Our personal baggage was already well cut down. Jerry, Kermit, and I took the naturalist's fly to sleep under, and a very light little tent extra for one who might fall sick. Rondon, Lyra, and the Doctor took one of their own tents. The things that we carried were necessities: food, medicines, beddings, instruments for determining the altitude and longitude and latitude, except a few books, each in small compass. Lyra's were in German, consisting of 2 tiny volumes of Goethe and Schiller. Kermit's were in Portuguese. Mine, all in English, included the last 2 volumes of Gibbon, the plays of Sophocles, More's Utopia, Marcus Aurelius, and Epictetus, the 2 latter lent me by a friend Major Shipton of the Regulars and military attaché at Buenos Aires. If our canoe voyage was prosperous, we would gradually lighten the loads by eating the provisions. If we met with accidents, such as losing canoes and men in the rapids, or losing men in encounters with Indians, or if we encountered overmuch fever and dysentery, the loads would lighten themselves. We were all armed. We took no cartridges for sport. Cherry had some to be used sparingly for collecting specimens. The others were to be used, unless in the unlikely event of having to repel an attack, only to procure food. The food and the arms we carried represented all reasonable precautions against suffering starvation. But of course, if the course of the river proved very long and difficult, if we lost our boats over the falls or in rapids, or had to make too many and too long portages, or were brought to a halt by impassable swamps, then we would have to reckon with starvation as a possibility. Anything might happen. We were about to go into the unknown, and no one could say what it held. Side note. The first 4 days before we struck the upper rapids, and during which we made nearly 17 kilometres, are of course not included when I speak of our making our way down the rapids. I hope that this year the Ananas, or pineapple, will also be put on the map. One of Colonel Rondon's subordinates is to attempt the descent of the river. We passed the headwaters of the pineapple on the high plateau. Very possibly we passed its mouth, although it is also possible that it empties into the Canamara, or Tapajos. But it will not be, put on the map until someone descends and finds out where, as a matter of fact, it really does go. It would be well if a geographical society of standing would investigate the formal and official charges made by Colonel Rondon, an officer and a gentleman of the highest repute, against Mr. Savage Landor. Colonel Rondon, in an official report to the Brazilian government, has written a scathing review of Mr. Landor. He states that Mr. Savage Landor did not perform, and did not even attempt to perform, the work he had contracted to do in exploration for the Brazilian government. Mr. Landor had asserted and promised that he would go through unknown country along the line of 11 degrees latitude south, and, as Colonel Rondon states, it was because of this proposal of his that the Brazilian government gave him material financial assistance in advance. However, Colonel Rondon sets forth that Mr. Landor did not keep his word, or make any serious effort to fulfil his moral obligation to do as he had said he would do. In a letter to me, under date of May 1, 1914, a letter which has been published in full in France, Colonel Rondon goes on at length into the question of what territory Mr. Landor had traversed. Colonel Rondon states that, excepting on one occasion, Mr. Landor, wandering off a beaten trail, immediately got lost and shortly returned to his starting point, without making any discoveries. He kept to old, well-travelled routes. One sentence of the Colonel's letter to me runs as follows. I can guarantee to you that in Brazil Mr. Landor did not cross a hand's breadth of land that had not been explored, the greater part of it many centuries ago. As regards Mr. Landor's sole and brief experience in leaving a beaten route, Colonel Rondon states that at São Manuel, Mr. Landor engaged from Senhor José Sotero Barreto, the revenue officer of Mato Grosso at São Manuel, a guide to lead him across a well-travelled trail which connects the Tapajós with the Madeira via the Canama. Senhor Barreto, a gentleman of high standing, related this last incident to Fiella when Fiella descended the Tapajós, and, by the way, Fiella's trip down the Papagaio, Janeiro, and Tapajós was infinitely more important than all the work Mr. Landor did in South America put together. Lieutenants Pirineus and Mello, mentioned in the body of this work, inform me that they accompanied Mr. Landor on most of his overland trip before he embarked at the Arenas, and that he simply followed the high road or else the telegraph line, and furthermore, Colonel Rondon states that the Indians whom Mr. Landor encountered and photographed were those educated at the missions. Colonel Rondon's official report to the Brazilian government and his letter to me are of interest to all geographers and other scientific men who have any concern with the alleged discoveries of Mr. Landor. They contain very grave charges, with which it is not necessary for me to deal. Suffice it to say that Mr. Landor's accounts of his alleged exploration cannot be considered as entitled to the slightest serious consideration until he has satisfactorily and in detail answered Colonel Rondon, and this he has thus far signally failed to do. Fortunately, there are numerous examples of exactly the opposite type of work. From the days of Humboldt and Spix Martinussen to the present time, German explorers have borne a conspicuous part in the exploration of South America. As representatives of the men and women who have done such capital work, who have fronted every hazard and hardship and laboured in the scientific spirit, and who have added greatly to our fund of geographic, biologic, and ethnographic knowledge, I may mention Miss Snethlage and Herr Kohl von der Steinen. The music this week is from 1920. It's by Marion Harris, who we've had on the show before, and it's called Left All Alone Blues.
My hobby leaves me, I have the blues, because it pleases me to be left here, flat here, just like a bone born alone. I said on a lone. No woman knows if she has a traveling husband just where he goes, unless she follows on and nails him, trails him, just like a faithful old dog. Now that old song, where has my Highland laddie gone? If there's a mouthful, we never do know just where they do go, how they keep us guessing. Now isn't it distressing? I have the blues when my hubby leaves, although I wouldn't accuse. Each time he says goodbye, I get those same old left all alone again blues. 'cause I used to have a good time all time, every time I might roam. I said when I'd roam, when we first met, why we could render a duet, but now hubby sings, I won't go home till morning, never one short sands of home, sweet home. Now I like cats, I'm fond of rabbits, and I like dogs, and even goldfish, it's lucky maybe, for there's a baby grand piano coming, then I'll start a humming. I have the blues, only hubby dear can cure my terrible blues. Each time he says goodbye, I get so gone, left all alone again blue.
And now on to the main feature. At the Mountains of Madness, Chapter 11. Still another time have I come to a place where it is difficult to proceed. I ought to be hardened by this stage, but there are some experiences and intimations which scar too deeply to permit of healing, and leave only such an added sensitiveness that memory re-inspires all the original horror. We saw, as I have said, certain obstructions on the polished floor ahead. And may I add that our nostrils were assailed almost simultaneously by a very curious intensification of the strange prevailing fetor, now quite plainly mixed with the nameless stench of those others which had gone before. The light of the second torch left no doubt of what the obstructions were, and we dared approach them only because we could see, even from a distance, that they were quite as past all harming power as had been the 6 similar specimens unearthed from the monstrous star-mounded graves at poor Lake's camp. They were, indeed, as lacking in completeness as most of those we had unearthed, though it grew plain from the thick, dark green pool gathering around them that their incompleteness was of infinitely greater recency. There seemed to be only 4 of them, whereas Lake's bulletins would have had suggested no less than 8 as forming the group which had preceded us. To find them in this state was wholly unexpected, and we wondered what sort of monstrous struggle had occurred down here in the dark. Penguins, attacked in a body, retaliate savagely with their beaks, and our ears now made certain the existence of a rookery far beyond. Had those others disturbed such a place and aroused murderous pursuit? The obstructions did not suggest it, for penguins' beaks against that tough tissue that Lake had dissected could hardly account for the terrible damage our approaching glance was beginning to make out. Besides, the huge blind birds we had seen appeared to be singularly peaceful. Had there then been a struggle among those others, and were the absent 4 responsible? If so, where were they? Were they close at hand and likely to form an immediate menace to us? We glanced anxiously at some of the smooth-floored lateral passages as we continued our slow and frankly reluctant approach. Whatever the conflict was, it had clearly been that which had frightened the penguins into their unaccustomed wandering. It must, then, have arisen near that faintly heard rookery in the incalculable gulf beyond, since there were no signs that any birds had normally dwelt here. Perhaps, we reflected, there had been a hideous running fight with the weaker party seeking to get back to the cache sledges when their pursuers finished them. One could picture the demonic fray between the nameless monstrous entities as it surged out of that black abyss, with great clouds of frantic penguins squawking and scurrying ahead. I say that we approached those spiralling and incomplete obstructions slowly and reluctantly. Would to heaven we had never approached them at all, but had run back at top speed out of that blasphemous tunnel with the greasily smooth floors and the degenerate murals aping and mocking the things they had superseded, run back before we had seen what we did see, and before our minds were burned with something which will never let us breathe easily again. Both of our torches were turned on the prostrate objects, so that we soon realized the dominant factor in their incompleteness. Mauled, compressed, twisted, and ruptured as they were, their chief common injury was total decapitation. From each one of them, the tentacled starfish head had been removed, and as we drew near we saw that the manner of removal looked more like some hellish tearing or suction than like any ordinary form of cleavage. Their noisome, dark green ichor formed a large spreading pool, but its stench was half overshadowed by the newer and stranger stench, here more pungent than at any other point along our route. Only when we had come very close to the sprawling obstructions could we trace that second unexplainable fetor to the immediate source, and the instant we did so, Danforth, remembering certain very vivid sculptures of the Old One's history in the Permian Age 150 million years ago, gave vent to a nerve-tortured cry, which echoed hysterically through that vaulted and archaic passage with the evil, palmer-set carvings. I came only just short of echoing his cry myself, for I had seen those primal sculptures too, and had shudderingly admired the way the nameless artist had suggested that hideous slime coating found on certain incomplete and prostrate Old Ones, those whom the frightful Shoggoths had characteristically slain, and sucked to a ghastly headlessness in the great war of resubjugation. They were infamous nightmare sculptures, even when telling of age-old bygone things, for Shoggoths and their work ought not to be seen by human beings or portrayed by any beings. The mad author of the Necronomicon had nervously tried to swear that none had been bred on this planet, and that only drugged dreamers had even conceived of them. Formless protoplasm, able to mock and reflect all forms and organs and processes, viscous agglutinations of bubbling cells, rubbery, 15-foot spheroids, infinitely plastic and ductile. Slaves of suggestion, builders of cities, more and more sullen, more and more intelligent, more and more amphibious, more and more imitative. Great God, what madness even made those blasphemous Old Ones willing to use and carve such things? And now, when Danforth and I saw the freshly glistening and reflectively iridescent black slime which clung thickly to these headless bodies and stank obscenely with that new unknown odour whose cause only a diseased fancy could envisage, and clung to those bodies and sparkled less volumelessly on a smooth part of the accursedly re-sculpted walls in a series of grouped dots, we understood the quality of cosmic fear to its uttermost depths. It was not fear of those four missing others, for all too well did we suspect that they would do no harm again. Poor devils! After all, they were not evil things of their kind. They were the men of another age and another order of being. Nature had played a hellish jest on them, as it will on any others that human madness, callousness, or cruelty may hereafter dig up in that hideously dead or sleeping polar waste, and this was their tragic homecoming. They had not even been savages, for what indeed had they done? That awful awakening in the cold of an unknown epoch, perhaps an attack by the furry, fanatical, barking quadrupeds, and a day's defence against them and the equally frantic white simians, with the queer wrappings and paraphernalia. Poor Lake, poor Gedney, and the poor Old Ones. Scientists to the last, what had they done that we would not have done in their place? God, what an intelligence and persistence! What a facing of the incredible, just as those carven kinsmen's and forebears had faced things only a little less incredible. Radiates, vegetables, monstrosities, starspawn, whatever they had been, they were men. They had crossed the icy peaks on whose templed slopes they had once worshipped and roamed among the tree ferns. They had found their dead city brooding under its curse, and had read its carven latter days as we had done. They had tried to reach their living fellows in fabled depths of blackness. And what had they found? All this flashed in unison through the thoughts of Danforth and me as we looked from the headless slime-coated shapes to the loathsome palm-set sculptures and the diabolical dot-groups of fresh slime on the walls beside them, looked and understood what must have triumphed and survived down there in the Cyclopean water city of that nighted, penguin-fringed abyss, whence even now a sinister curling mist had begun to belch pallidly, as if in answer to Danforth's hysterical scream. The shock of recognizing that monstrous slime and headlessness had frozen us into mute, motionless statues, and it is only through latter conversations that we learned of the complete identity of our thoughts at that moment. It seemed eons that we stood there, but actually it could not have been more than 10 or 15 seconds. That hateful pallid mist curled forward as if veritably driven by some remoter advancing bulk. And then came the sound, which upset much of what we had just decided, and in so doing broke the spell and enabled us to run like mad past squawking, confused penguins over our former trail back to the city, along ice-sunken megalithic corridors to the great open circle, and up the archaic spiral ramp in a frenzied automatic plunge for the sane outer air and the light of day. The new sound, as I have intimated, upset much that we had decided, because it was what poor Lake's dissection had led us to attribute to those we had judged dead. It was, Danforth later told me, precisely what he had caught in infinitely muffled form when at that spot beyond the alley corner, above the glacial level, and it certainly had a shocking resemblance to the wind pipings we had both heard around the lofty mountain caves. At the risk of seeming puerile, I will add another thing too, if only because of the surprising way Danforth's impressions chimed with mine. Of course, common reading is what prepared us both to make the interpretation, though Danforth has hinted at queer notions about unsuspected and forbidden sources to which Poe may have had access when writing his Arthur Gordon Pym a century ago. It will be remembered that in the fantastic tale there is a word of unknown but terrible and prodigious significance connected with the Antarctic, and it's screamed eternally by the gigantic spectrally snowy birds of that malign region's core. T'Kelly-Lee, T'Kelly-Lee. That, I may admit, is exactly what we thought we heard conveyed by that sudden sound behind the advancing white mist, that insidious, musical piping over a singularly wide range. We were in full flight before three notes or syllables had been uttered, though we knew that the swiftness of the old ones would enable any scream roused and pursuing survivor of the slaughter to overtake us in a moment if it really wished to do so. We had a vague hope, however, that non-aggressive conduct and a display of kindred reason might cause such a being to spare us in case of capture, if only from scientific curiosity. After all, if such a one had nothing to fear for itself, it would have no motive in harming us. Concealment being futile at this juncture, we used our torch for a running glance behind, and perceived that the mist was thinning. We would see, at last, a complete and living specimen of those others. Again came that insidious, musical piping, T'Kelly-Lee, T'Kelly-Lee. Then, noting that we were actually gaining on our pursuer, it occurred to us that the entity might be wounded. We could take no chances, however, since it was very obviously approaching in answer to Danforth's scream, rather than in flight from any other entity. The timing was too close to admit of doubt. Of the whereabouts of that less conceivable and less mentionable nightmare, that fetid, unglimpsed mountain of slime-spewing protoplasm, whose rays had conquered the abyss and sent land pioneers to recarve and squirm through the burrows of the hills, we could form no guess, and it cost us a genuine pang to leave this probably crippled old one, perhaps a lone survivor, to the peril of recapture and a nameless fate. Thank heavens we did not slacken our run. The curling mist had thickened again, and was driving ahead with increased speed, whilst the straying penguins in our rear were squawking and screaming and displaying signs of panic really surprising in view of their relatively minor confusion when we had passed them. Once more came that sinister wide-ranged piping, T'Kelly-Lee, T'Kelly-Lee. We had been wrong. The thing was not wounded, but had merely paused on encountering the bodies of its fallen kindred and the hellish slime inscription above them. We could never know what the demon message was, but those burials at Lake's camp had shown how much importance the beings attached to their dead. Our recklessly used torch now revealed ahead of us the large open cavern where various ways converged, and we were glad to be leaving behind those morbid, palmoset sculptures, almost felt even more than scarcely seen behind. Another thought which the advent of the cave inspired was the possibility of losing our pursuer at this bewildering focus of large galleries. There were several of the blind albino penguins in the open space, and it seemed clear that their fear of the oncoming entity was extreme to the point of unaccountability. If at that point we dimmed our torch to the very lowest limit of travelling need, keeping it strictly in front of us, the frightened squawking motions of the huge birds in the mist might muffle our footfalls, screen our true course, and somehow set up a false lead. Amidst the churning, spiralling fog, the littered and unglistening floor of the main tunnel beyond this point, as differing from the other morbidly polished burrows, could hardly form a highly distinguishing feature, even so far as we could conjecture, for those indicated special senses which had made the old ones partly, though imperfectly, independent of light in emergencies. In fact, we were somewhat apprehensive, lest we go astray ourselves in our haste, for we had, of course, decided to keep straight on towards the dead city, since the consequences of loss in those unknown foothill honeycombings would be unthinkable. The fact that we survived and emerged is sufficient proof that the thing did take a wrong gallery whilst we providentially hit the right one. The penguins alone could not have saved us, but in conjunction with the mist, they seemed to have done so. Only a benign fate kept the curling vapours thick enough at the right moment, for they were constantly shifting and threatening to vanish. Indeed, they did lift for a second, just before we emerged from the nauseously re-sculptured tunnel into the cave, so that we actually caught one first and only half glimpse of the oncoming entity as we cast a final desperately fearful glance backward before dimming the torch and mixing with the penguins in the hope of dodging pursuit. If the fate which screened us was benign, that which gave us half a glimpse was infinitely the opposite. For to that flash of semi-vision can be traced a full half of the horror which has ever since haunted us. Our exact motive in looking back again was perhaps no more than the immemorial instinct of the pursued to gauge the nature and course of its pursuer. Or perhaps it was an automatic attempt to answer a subconscious question raised by one of our senses. In the midst of our flight, with all our faculties centred on the problem of escape, we were in no condition to observe and analyse details. Yet even so, our latent brain cells must have wondered at the message brought to them by our nostrils. Afterward, we realised what it was, that our retreat from the fetid slime coating of those headless obstructions and the coincident approach of the pursuing entity had not brought us the exchange of stenches which logic called for. In the neighbourhood of the prostrate things, that new and lately inexplicable fetor had been wholly dominant, but by this time it ought to have largely given place to the nameless stench associated with those others. This it had not done, for instead the newer and less bearable smell was now virtually undiluted, and growing more and more poisonously insistent every second. So we glanced back, simultaneously it would appear, though no doubt the incipient motion of one promoted the imitation of the other. As we did so, we flashed both torches full strength at the momentarily thinned mist, either from sheer primitive anxiety to see all we could, or in a less primitive but equally unconscious effort to dazzle the entity before we dimmed our light and dodged among the penguins of the labyrinth centre ahead. Unhappy act! Not Orpheus himself or Lot's wife paid much more dearly for a backward glance. And again came that shocking wide-range piping, Tekeli-li, Tekeli-li. I might as well be frank, even if I cannot bear to be quite direct in stating what we saw. Though at the time we felt it was not to be admitted even to each other. The words reaching the reader can never even suggest the awfulness of the sight itself. It crippled our consciousness so completely that I wonder we had the residual sense to dim our torches as planned and to strike the right tunnel towards the dead city. Instinct alone must have carried us through, perhaps better than reason could have done. Though if that was what saved us, we paid a high price. Of reason, we certainly had little enough left. Danforth was totally unstrung, and the first thing I remember of the rest of the journey was hearing him light-headedly chant an hysterical formula in which I alone of mankind could have found anything but insane irrelevance. It reverberated in falsetto echoes among the squawks of the penguins, reverberated through the vaultings ahead, and, thank God, through the now empty vaultings behind. He could not have begun it at once, else we would not have been alive and blindly racing. I shudder to think of what a shade of difference in his nervous reactions might have brought. South Station under, Washington under, Park Street under Kendall, Central, Harvard. The poor fellow was chanting the familiar stations of the Boston-Cambridge tunnel that burrowed through our peaceful native soil thousands of miles away in New England. Yet to me the ritual had neither irrelevance nor home feeling. It held only horror, because I knew unerringly the monstrous, nefandious analogy that it suggested. We had affected upon looking back to see a terrible and incredible moving entity if the mists were thin enough, but of that entity we had formed a clear idea. What we did see, for the mists were indeed all too malignly thinned, was something altogether different and immeasurably more hideous and detestable. It was the utter, objective embodiment of the fantastic novelist's thing that should not be, and its nearest comprehensible analogue is a vast, onrushing subway train as one sees it from a station platform, the great black front looming colossally out of an infinite subterranean distance, constellated with strangely coloured lights, and filling the prodigious burrow as a piston fills a cylinder. But we were not on a station platform. We were on the track ahead as the plastic nightmare column of fetid black iridescence oozed tightly onward through its 15-foot sinus, gathering unholy speed and driving before it a spiral re-thickening cloud of the pallid abyss vapour. It was a terrible, indescribable thing, vaster than any subway train, a shapeless congeries of protoplasmic bubbles, faintly self-luminous, and with myriads of temporal eyes forming and unforming as pustules of greenish light all over the tunnel-filling front that bored down upon us, crushing the frantic penguins and slithering over the glistening floor that it and its kind had swept so evilly free of all litter. Still came that eldritch mocking cry, "Tekeli-li! Tekeli-li!" And at last we remembered that the demonic Shoggoths, given life through the plastic organ patterns solely by the old ones, and having no language save that which the dot groups expressed, had likewise no voice save the imitated accents of their bygone masters. So that's it for today, except to remind you that the opening music is by Victor Valdez from the Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.